welcome to A World on Fire Season 2. And I am here with my co-host for this episode, Mr. Martin Gray. How are you, Mark?
Hiya, I'm very well. Last time I did one of the shows, I was full of cold or virus or something. I kept going, but this time I may slurp a little because I have a nice cup of tea, but I should sound a little better, hopefully. How are you?
I am fantastic, and you sound worlds better. So just to, give some of the listeners maybe a peek here at what's going on. So you remember back in the 70s especially, and of course they've done it before that and after that, but it happened a lot at Marvel in the 70s where they would get into a crunch and they couldn't get an issue out on time, so they'd do a fill-in. You remember that?
I do, certainly, yes. Good days. Bill Mantlo usually, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, he was definitely a fill-in guy back then. So, you know, we had a dilemma over the weekend where we were supposed to do a recording, but it couldn't all happen. So I thought, you know what, where is a really cool JSA story we could talk about? And I recruited you to help me with this one. And I thought, wait a minute, what about Justice League of America 21 and 22 from 1963?
Oh, shoot. I thought you meant from 1987.
Yeah, I had never read this story before, even though I have it in the archive editions here. I have three of the volumes, and I bought them, and I got them for a really, really good deal. I think I paid less than $10 a piece for them, maybe $10 at the most, and they're $50 hardcover, so I was ecstatic to get them for that deal.
I'm very jealous. Was that Ollie's shop that I keep hearing about?
It could have been there, or it could have actually even been an eBay seller that was selling them very cheaply. I'm not sure, but they were still even wrapped in the plastic and everything. They were still very new.
Wow, quite a bargain. That's brilliant. So, I mean, if we're going to do a fill-in podcast, this is a good subject. Whether it becomes a good show, blame me if it's not. But I'm just talking about, incidentally, just going, do you know why, going off topic already, do you know why Bill Mantlo did so many of those fill-ins?
You know, before he got on to ROM and Micronauts, I feel like all he did were fill-ins, but I don't know. I don't know what the story is there.
Well, apparently during Marvel's man's short-lived tenure as editor-in-chief of Marvel, because they were having to have so many fill-ins and reprints, he decided to create a comic on the schedule under production editor John Verpooten, unofficially titled Marvel Fill-In Comics, assigned Bill Mantlo to be the writer. And what they would do is, when the new Witch comics were generally, you know, looking to be in trouble, or if it was like, you know, writers like Steve Englehart that tended to be quite behind sometimes, they'd get Bill Mantlo to come up with a story featuring maybe two or three of the characters that might need fill-ins, and then they could use it in any one of those comics. So it was just that clever. Really, really good idea.
Yeah, that is a real brainy idea there. I'm glad Mr. Wolfman thought of that. And you know, that's what we're playing the part of Marv Wolfman and Bill Mantlo today, you and I.
we are. And, you know, I do have a mention of Marv Wolfman in my notes, so he'll come up again if I remember.
Oh, good. Good.
Not secure.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just, I didn't look at any dates or anything. It's just happenstance, but these are, you know, this year, these comics will be turning 60 years old, 1963 to 2023. So when did you first read this story, Mark?
Well, not in 1963, because I wasn't born until 64, but I did first read them in, oh, goodness, now I'm guessing the year, but round about 1971 in the DC Super Spectacular World's Greatest Superheroes, the one that everyone will remember probably with the iconic Neil Adams cover of the Justice League and the Justice Society on the front and the back. And it was reprinted there, and it was just such a good read. If you're going to have the world's greatest superheroes, having the first team up of the JSA and the JLA, I think you can't go far wrong.
No, not at all. Yeah, this story has been reprinted many, many times. And I bought these archive editions and thought, well, these are nice. This was a great deal. I'll just put them here on my shelf and I'll get to them eventually. And, you know, I thought, let me look in these. And I was checking it out and I thought, wow, I know this cover, especially the cover to 21 here. It's just, emblazoned in my brain here. So I thought, what about this story? So I read it and I thought, this was pretty cool. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, it's a two-parter.
Yes, I know, because when you said let's do a fill-in podcast, do Justice League 21, I thought, hey, one comic, hurrah.
Right, I thought, oh, we'll whip through this in no time, and I got to the end and I thought, uh-oh, I guess I better give Mark the bad news.
Yeah, no, I won't pick awake in the middle of the night to have the happy news. Well, anyway, you can't complain. It's only fair. We're going to do part one. We'll do part two. And reading this team up is not a trial.
Not at all. So yeah, let's jump in here. So Justice League of America 21, and it was cover dated August 1973, and it was on sale somewhere in the June 20th era week of 1963. But what are your thoughts on this cover here? Like I said, this cover is in my brain, even though I had never read this story before we were going to cover it here.
Well, just on the slight off chances of single reader who doesn't know the cover, will describe it. It's purple background, red, white, and blue of the Justice League's original logo, and you have the Justice League join hands around their meeting table in the secret sanctuary, like a seance around a crystal ball, and coming from the magic sphere is a cloud, and in the cloud, looking down on them, is a very, very smiling figures of the Justice Society of America. And we know that because it says in the blurb, this was around the time, a few months, I think, after, or maybe a year after, Flash of Two Worlds, and we had the first beginnings of the Justice League and the Justice Society teaming up when Flash met Flash. And I think there was another little team up in between with a couple of the characters in the Flash as well. But I mean, even kids who had read the Flash, they wouldn't necessarily be able to recognize these characters if they weren't around at the time. So I think this is quite an intriguing cover. And, you know, the words Crisis on Earth One, you think, what's Earth One again, if you don't actually know? But it's such an intriguing cover because the Justice League looking so, you know, so tentative about things, so wary, and the JSA looking down, smiling, you know, we've got this all handled. It's like, I think it's just a thing of wonder. But the fact that the flags aren't on there, you know, would make it more difficult for kids to realise it's a Justice Society if they weren't, you know, pretty or fair with things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely love this cover. You know, like you said, one of the cover blurbs also says, back after 12 years, the legendary superstars of the Justice Society of America. And like I said, they're all looking down at the Justice League with these big smiles on their faces. And Superman, Aquaman, and especially the Martian Manhunter and Wonder Woman, they're all like, you know, mouths agape, like, like, wow, like as if they almost are, you know, looking up to these heroes from another world.
Absolutely. And does it not blow your mind when you think that, you know, back after 12 years? So if that was now, that would be like, oh, back since, not seen since 2010. I mean, we've got characters that we've not seen longer than that. And it doesn't seem as quite as epoch making if someone like Firehawk suddenly reappears.
Yeah, right. And I did forget to mention it's Mike Sikowski and Murphy Anderson is the art team on this cover here with letters by Ira Schnapp. But yeah, absolutely love this cover. I think it's gorgeous. It's iconic. It's if I could get a print of this even and, you know, hang a big blown up huge print of it in my house, I would. Well, if my wife would allow it, I definitely would.
I'm sure you can find it somewhere. I think you should start working on the missus and see what happens there.
Yeah, I need to sweeten her up here, buy her some chocolates or something, maybe flowers.
You can do it, Billy.
So what do you think of this opening splash page here? Now, I really like this. This is, again, I think the cover's a bit better, but because this splash page is a bit busy. Now, this is a Gardner Fox script, and then Mike Sikowski and Bernard Sachs artwork inside with Gaspar Saladino letters. But I really, really do like this splash page here that kind of, you know, kind of has the same vibe as the cover, right?
Absolutely, but it's reversed, isn't it? So you've got the Justice Society looking at the Justice League in the cloud. And so it's obviously just before they made contact. But I think it's great because you've got the usual roll call of the Justice League down one side. Then across the bottom in an L shape, you've got representing, whichever, the Justice Society of America. You've got the Atom, Black Canary, Dr. Fate, Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and Owlman. And yeah, I mean, the image is great. I mean, I think Bernard Sachs is a good inker on Mike Sikowski. And you've got your precy of what's to come, which I'm always in two minds about those, because on the one hand, it's like I'm quite happy to read the story and find out what's going on. On the other hand, it's a little preview, like you get on TV shows and things, of what's to come, so it might build the excitement. But what I mean, this sounds strange, but what I really like is just the logo, not the logo, the title lettering of Crisis on Earth One. It's just so cool looking with On Earth One in, you know, green full cap. It's Alex, and then Crisis in lowercase, and just a quite an advertising type font. I think it's just brilliant.
Yeah, and I do love too how the Atom is between Batman and Martian Manhunter, and he's it looks like he's sitting on this little levitating chair, and they're holding hands like at a seance. And of course, you know, his hands are all tiny, so they're just kind of like holding on with their like thumb and pointer finger there to Atom.
Yeah, I mean, if memory serves, because you look at this and think, why doesn't Atom just, you know, go to his normal size and sit there? But as I recall, it must be decades since I read the Atom's induction into the league. It was about issue 14 or something. But at the end, I think he's quite sad because he can't be as big as everybody else because the way his powers work, if he went to full size, his costume would disappear. And at that point, the league members weren't out to each other in terms of their secret identities. So he had to stay small at all times when at the meeting. So then someone says, ah, but we made you a little chair. And it was so nice for him.
Yeah, it looks really, really cool. So, all right, well, if you're ready to jump into it here, I'll just do a quick little synopsis here. If you don't mind, I will. I actually, you know, we talked about this when we were messaging that there's a really good recap of issue one on the first interior page to number 22 here, right?
There is. It's like the whole page basically is words. And on the one hand, it's like, what a lot of words. On the other hand, if you came in straight into 22 without having read 21, or you had a bit of a memory lapse, you can go straight into the story after, you know, wading through that page of words. And to be honest, it's not more words than you get on an average Garden of Fox page. I mean, look at the second page of this story. Mm-hmm. Where that's what the real threat the Justice League faces, being crushed by the words. It's, you know, this is where Roy Thomas learned his craft.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, all right, well, I'll just jump into it right here. And it says, you know, this is the story is Crisis on Earth One. And it says, there is a second Earth, almost a duplicate of our own, which coexists with our world in different vibratory dimensions. And just as a group of superheroes has banded together to form the Justice League of America on our Earth, so has similar team been formed on Earth Two, the Justice Society of America. Meeting in the borderland between the two Earths, the crime champions, a sextet of villains from both Earths, plot to commit a series of robberies and then hide out in perfect safety on each other's Earths, where they are unknown. However, as a precautionary measure, the Flashes of Earth 1 and Earth 2, the only ones who might identify the villains in their separate Earth havens, are quickly imprisoned inside inescapable energy bubbles in the borderland between the two Earths. The criminal coup is successfully pulled off despite the attempts of the Justice League of America and the Justice Society of America to stop it. In a follow-up battle, the Justice League members become trapped in their Earth One headquarters, from which they are unable to escape because it is ringed with awesome magical powers. As a last desperate hope, they resort to a seance, which materializes the Justice Society members inside the JLA headquarters. With the magical help of Dr. Fate, the Justice League of America is shifted to Earth 2 to resume its battle with its regular foes, while the Justice Society of America remains on Earth 1 to pursue the arch-villains from its world. So, you know, a little long there, a little long-winded, but I think it got us right where we need to be, right?
It did. You can get straight in there, and, you know, it misses out the sheer panel-by-panel joy of issue 21, but it gets you there. Mm-hmm. I mean...
Yeah, so we got I like how Batman on the second page there, he's got his, you know, fist down on the table, and he says, "Fellow members, we are assembled here today because of the challenge from a new team of evildoers, the crime champions." And I love how that's a trope that lasted a very long time, and it's even used on television a lot too, where the villains will just say, "This is what we're gonna do, good guys, try to stop us."
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely no reason for it that I can either think of or recall from reading the story at all. It's just, you know, we want to show the heroes that we're better than you, and inevitably they aren't.
Right, so Batman then goes on to say, Kronos, Felix Faust, and Dr. Alchemy have alerted us to the fact that they intend to rob the Powers City Bank, a sunken ship, and a Safeway armored car. They boast they will rob and elude us, no matter what we do. And I love that next panel where all the heroes are like, oh yeah, we'll teach them. They kind of think like they just made a big mistake in telling us what they're going to do, because we will stop them. And they split into teams, right?
They do. I mean, it's just your classic Gardner Fox JLA format, and it still works this day. Split the teams up into three and, you know, send them off against individual or duos of villains. It's classic, works.
Mm-hmm. And then Martian Manhunter says, those characters never learn. Adam, let's you and I with Aquaman team up to teach that occult magician Felix Faust a lesson. Batman says, Wonder Woman, you and Green Lantern and I will duel with the time thief Kronos. And Flash says, Superman, Green Arrow, and I will take on Dr. Alchemy and his Philosopher's Stone. And there's a really cool panel. There's no border really to it or anything. And it's just all the heroes kind of marching out, you know, shoulder to shoulder. I really like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose the prototype for the Justice League Unlimited cartoon beginning, mm-hmm. where you've got them all marching towards the camera dramatically.
Yeah, and then we peek in on the Justice Society, which is really cool because, you know, they mentioned this is their first time back together, you know, meeting in their modernized headquarters. And there's a little editor's note, too, when it mentions, like you said earlier, the Flash of Two Worlds, how, you know, the Jay Garrick Flash and the... I was going to say Wally West, but no, that's too far in the future, right?
A little bit. I mean, he's around at this point, but yeah.
Yeah, so that's they make mention of that, but they show these guys meeting up for the first time here. And I do like how then on the following page, page three, they're all getting together here, and it's Black Canary, Dr. Fate, Hourman, Hawkman, the Atom, the Flash, and Green Lantern. And then Dr. Fate has letters in his hands, and he makes mention of, you know, hey, they have revised bylaws, and it calls for a rotating membership of 7. We have been chosen by lot for our first case. Though they aren't here, I have congratulatory messages from Starman, Sandman, Wonder Woman, and Dr. Midnight, and the others. I like how he has to mention the other people in the JSA there.
But it's, yeah, I mean, they love, I suppose, the society, because they do love their bylaws. It's like the Legion with their constitution. But what I find amazing to my modern eyes is on the previous page, you know, back after 12 years, the first shot we get of the Justice Society in those swanky new headquarters, it's, you know, it's like, what, a quarter of the page, a tiny shot of them, you know, and it's great. It's just amazing, really, that you haven't got a huge, great half a page or something shot of them for the first time.
Yeah, good point. It would have, you know, it's a huge deal, so it would have been nice to have something a little more grandiose there, I guess, right?
I think so, but then again, but when I was a kid, I remember reading this, and I knew the Justice League, and I don't think I'd really come across the Justice Society at that point. Or had I? The first team I read was 100. Was that before or after the Super Spectacular? Anyway, but I just remember I didn't know the Justice Society particularly. And just seeing that, you know, this other Hawkman without wings, and the guy with the wings is the Flash, and apparently blonde here, and there's the Atom who's full size. It was blowing my little mind.
And then I do like how they mentioned another comic in an editor's note there on page 3, where Green Lantern says, ever since Vandal Savage captured some of us and we were rescued by the two Flashes, I've looked forward to this get together. So I think that might be the one you were alluding to. Other. Yeah, I have to read that one, too. I have not read that one yet. Flash 137. I'll have to look that up. I don't think it's on the app, though.
Yeah, no, it's very good stuff.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out. And then we get a headshot of all the JSA members, which is really cool in the middle of the page there. I think the artwork's pretty good there. I like Fate, you know, Helmet, and Black Canary looks pretty good. Green Lantern looks great.
They all look excellent. And I'm thinking, I'm wondering whether this has been recolored, because as I'm reading it on the app rather than my old comic. But it's mentioned that, you know, there's a few gray hairs showing. And in my memory, I may see if I can find it online at some point, but in my memory, I don't know what it's like in the archive, you know, whatever that you're reading it in, the omnibus. Black Canary, I'm sure she has a few wrinkles and a few grey hairs, even though it's a wig. I'm sure they did. Because it says, you know, they look a little older, and they don't look older at all here in this version.
No, they do not. It does say that in the caption box about them. They have some grey hairs. But no, none of them looks older in the least. They look like they're in their prime.
Yeah, Mike. It's only 12 years, I suppose. But if the caption's telling us that, I want to believe it.
Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, they have the same surprise as well as the Justice League had, where, you know, the villains are saying, hey, we're about to pull some shenanigans and you just try and stop us. And they say it's the Fiddler, the Wizard, and the Icicle. And they're going to try to commit crimes and see if you can stop us. And it's a trio of $1 million robberies. I love that.
Absolutely. I wonder whether they'll find them. And I like that, you know, you've got the caption probably the first time we've seen the Justice League, and it was in the about 23 years afterwards, just explaining the concept of the parallel worlds in about 80 words, something like that. And, you know, and then, of course, you know, years later, you know, because some little kiddie told Marv Wolfman or something, he couldn't understand it. We get Crisis on Infinite Earth, which I enjoyed, but, you know, goodness me, it undid so many good things.
Mm.
But this is where it all started, and this is a great way to start.
Yeah, I love it. So once they announce their, you know, they've got the Crooks agenda, so they're going after them. Black Canary on page 4, I feel younger already. That's great. Oh, she just needs a little action, and she feels younger already. And Flash, the Fiddler, what memories I have of him. And GL says, and I, one of my old nemesis, the Icicle.
It's lovely how thrilled they are to not just to be back together, but to be, you know, on the verge of going and punching someone.
That's what I was thinking, too. They're all like, yeah, I feel younger already. I'm going to get to go punch somebody. I think that's great.
I suppose if for years and years, you know, that had been pretty much their half their life, you know, going out and fighting crime and beating people up. And at this point, we don't know why the Justice Society retired. So it's just nice that they're back together.
Yeah, and you get Hawkman. He puts his arms around Flash and Adam and says, hey, shall we bring back our good old days of teaming up together? And then Black Canary says, how about it, Green Lantern? You and I had some great adventures side by side. Shall we relive them? And then Dr. Fate looks at Hourman and says, Hourman, it's been a long time, and I can hardly wait to get going. And another borderless panel of them kind of run. They're actually running into action, where I think the Justice League was just kind of walking mostly.
they're raring to go. It's a nice observation. And the previous panel, where Hawkman has his arms on Flash and Atom, I think that's one of the few panels in the book where you actually see that the Atom is shorter than everybody else. Because, no, I mean, even in the panel below, he doesn't look like the little tough guy that he's meant to be.
Yeah, he almost looks like he's just as tall as the Flash if they would stand up straight.
Yeah, and it's a good job Starman isn't there, that he's, you know, Black Canary's not saying, the good adventures we used to have, Starman, given what we learned later on.
Right. So what do you think of this page here, page 5, where Felix Faust here, I think this is pretty neat. So he's like kind of getting some plunder safe from a shipwreck here in that first panel. I really like that. He's almost like, it's almost like he's walking on water. He's pulling a Jesus here, and there's a steps down into it, and he's using his powers to like rip open this ship. I really like that panel.
Oh, it's just totally cool. I mean, Felix Faust was, I think, the first JLA villain I ever came across in, probably issue 10, the Fantastic Fingers of Felix Faust. In fact, we were looking at the cover the other night, weren't we? You've got some lovely poetic spells from him. It's excellent, excellent work. I mean, the fact, you know, he sends down the lightning bolt to make the hole in the ship, uses levitation to get the safe to come out. Then he's got the safe on a flying shell to flee so he can go and open it elsewhere. He's got style, Felix Faust.
Yeah, I love that. He's in a giant clamshell. It's raising him and the safe out of the water. But Aquaman is on a, I don't know if that's a dolphin or not, but Aquaman's on some kind of sea life here. And he's going to, you know, I'm going to stop you. And literally Felix Faust just waves his hand and makes the water go berserk. And it knocks him and the whales and all the other animals out of the way like they're nothing.
Oh, really, really. It's just cool. So, I mean, the fact that Aquaman's in, you know, in a corner of water and all the sea beasts, and he's very politely asking them to help. It's just the imagination and was sparking kids. Really wonderful.
Yeah, and Felix Faust, he pretty much knows all their weaknesses because he does that to, you know, get Aquaman out of the way. And then he throws these, like, fireballs at the Martian Manhunter, again, because he knows it's his weakness here, but he doesn't count on the Atom, who's, I guess, on his shoulder, maybe, and he starts kicking the fireballs away, which I find hilarious.
Hilarious, but just fantastic. I mean, that's just so cool. And then again, it's just a good example of JLA teamwork. If one of them is in trouble, the other one works out what to do.
Yeah, and then he says, now blow Martian Manhunter as hard as you can. And he sends him towards Felix Faust. And just as he's about to punch him, Felix Faust disappears. And, of course, they're just like, you know, what's going on? And they're like, well, he said he was going to rob this ship and elude us in the process. And he did both. And they're both kind of dumbfounded and rescue Aquaman there from getting tossed around in the water. But, you know, no time to waste. It's right back to another scene where I think that's Dr. Alchemy, isn't it, waiting for this armored truck?
It is in one of the worst costumes ever, given that it was designed. It looks like a horrible, horrible Checky Mac with a nasty, skanky green hood and black tights and blue boots. Very strange. I think, was this before or after he became Mr. Element? Was he Mr. Element before or after? Anyway, Mr. Element had a better look. With, I think he had a gas mask.
Yeah, this is not a great look. we'll just say that. But he's there waiting for this armored truck to come down the road, and he mentions his Philosopher's Stone, and he says about how the Flash hurled him into space, and this was in Showcase 14, The Man Who Changed the Earth. Another one. I got to write it down and go look for it. But he uses his Philosopher's Stone here to turn the wheels into stones, so then the truck just kind of skids off the road, and I guess they're not wearing their seatbelts and the doors aren't locked because the two guys in the armored truck just fall out.
It's very, very nicely drawn by Sikorsky. Very funny, really. Again, I mean, people like Mr. Element, Dr. Alchemy, it's the old Lex Luthor problem, not problem, but sort of dichotomy. You know, got these amazing Lex Luthor could invent anything and patent it. This guy could probably just turn things into gold. What on earth is he doing robbing trucks?
Yeah, really, that's a good point. Because then he uses his Philosopher's Stone here to change the truck into an airplane. And he's just going to jump in and take off. Apparently, he's a pilot as well. But he's going to do it. And it says, once again, Dr. Alchemy focuses his strange weapon. And he goes, now that I've transformed the truck's fenders into wings, I'll fly the armored truck away with its $1 million in cold cash. And here comes Superman, Green Arrow, and the Flash, and the three of them start heading towards him, but we see something happen to the Flash here, right?
Absolutely. He's vibrating so swiftly, he's being shaken apart. In fact, he disappears from this part of the story.
Yeah, and it's funny. Superman and Green Arrow are so jacked up on trying to stop Dr. Alchemy. They don't seem to notice at first, and they come right at him, but he uses his crazy stone here to turn the telephone pole and a fire hydrant into kryptonite. And that completely, I wouldn't say KOs, but, weakens Superman so bad that he's just laying face down and can barely move. And then he uses the Philosopher's Stone Green Arrow here to turn the roadway into some kind of a glue-like substance, and he's caught and can't get out.
Yeah, I mean, immensely powerful, but not so clever, because he could probably have done himself a favor by turning the bow and arrow into jelly or something.
And then he fires Green Arrow's like, well, I might be stuck, but I can still shoot an arrow, a stun arrow at you and knock you out. And he says, fire all the arrows you want, I'll turn every one of them into harmless weeds. And I thought that was an interesting thing to turn them into, weeds.
I know, and it's lovely. It's a lovely little image, and the glee on Dr. Alchemy's face, it's just so funny.
Yeah, he almost looks like an old Lithuanian woman there with his babushka on his head and turning into what looks like a little tree branch.
I know. He wasn't great. He got out in the end and became a good guy, I think, for a while at least.
And then he does what he says he's going to do. He jumps in his newly fashioned plane and takes off. And then all of a sudden, Green Arrow's like, oh, yeah, wait a minute. Where the heck is the Flash? He never showed up. And Alchemy yells out to them, the Flash has already been taken care of in a very special way. Ha ha. So I love how, again, not only did he tell him he's, going to commit this crime, he's also then telling him some information he doesn't really need to tell them about the Flash. I thought, buddy, you should have just kept your mouth shut.
Oh, they're addicted to self-narrating. They can't stop it.
And then the GA, fires a bunch of arrows at the fire hydrant near Superman. And it has paint. They have paint in them, and it's lead paint, because, again, this is the 60s. And paint still did absolutely have lead in it, and it covers the hydrant, so Superman can recover from his kryptonite bath here that he was getting, right?
Another example of classic JLA teamwork. He knows just what to do. I mean, I imagine that's why he carries the paint arrows, not just because he's mad and has anything you need.
Yeah, he's not going to graffiti up buildings with that. He's got a specific purpose for so him and Superman do catch up fairly quick with Dr. Alchemy here, and GA is riding on Superman's back there on page 11. I find that interesting. Not sure how he's stabilizing himself as Superman's flying through the air, but okay. And he shoots a bunch of arrows at the plane, but the plane just disappears, just like we saw our buddy Felix Faust as well, right?
Yeah, we're beginning to see a pattern here.
Yeah, and then now we see a looks like a flying dish going through the air with what looks to be a luchador here, a Mexican wrestler, but it's actually Kronos.
On a sun flying sundial, he's themed.
Yeah, this is awesome. And I don't know that I had ever seen him in this costume before. I was really taken aback by this. I'm like, what kind of crazy costume is this? He looks like one of those Mexican wrestler guys.
Well, but I can't remember what his next costume was. And he did go back to this one. What was his intermediate costume that you know?
Well, I didn't think he had any kind of I think he just had a face mask, almost like something like Robin has, like for Batman and Robin or something like that. It wasn't like a full mask like this, where just his eyes, mouth, and ears are sticking out, which I think that's funny. His ears are sticking out.
I'll have to have a little do some research, because I've got a vague idea that maybe it was in one of the super spectaculars when the tattooed man got a new costume. Maybe he did as well. But no, I mean, again, because I was reading a neighbor's old copies as a kid, you know, sort of from several years previously, I'd come across Kronos in the Atom, and I'm always been fascinated by, you know, time pool stories and time travels, and the fact that he's got this thing, a time bomb that he can throw at the wall of the bank and ages the bank so it just crumbles, which he could also just carry the bomb, but it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think this is the craziest, most fun, you know, segment of this issue here, where, you know, think about it. I understand he's a pretty tough villain, but we have Batman, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman coming after him. So I'm just thinking to myself, I see the pattern here with, you know, them doing what they said they were going to do, robbing something and getting away. But I just thought to myself, there's no way this dude is getting away from Batman, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman. It's not happening.
Well, you think that, but it happens.
Yeah, he's got this, you know, kooky little clock here. And as Wonder Woman tries to use her magic lasso on him, he says those clock hands darted out and move. Oh, she says, I'm sorry, those clock hands darted out and moved my lasso away from Kronos. And he's just like a little watch, pocket watch here is enough to defeat her magic lasso.
It really is. One of the things I actually love is that we've already had the arrow plane in this comic, and then we get the bat plane and the invisible jet. I mean, I wish we could go back to superheroes having planes, personal planes.
Well, everybody flies now.
Yeah, I mean, Wonder Woman's lost something.
Yeah, and then Batman comes swooping in, but he says, Chrono says, it will soon be crystal clear what I have in store for you, Batman. And this tiny little razor-sharp edge of the watch crystal slices the rope, and Batman and the Gotham Goliath, I've never heard that term description before for Batman, falls.
Oh, really? That was quite a Silver Age one, quite regular, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's wild. And it does. It cuts his bat line, and he starts flying towards the Earth, like he's in big trouble here. And then that quick, you know, lickety split, he turns his attention to Green Lantern here, and of course he has some kind of gas that comes out of his sundial here, and it's yellow, so that it just renders him helpless.
It's just impressive that, like you say, that this guy can take on several of the JLA's most powerful members and make a rather good showing for himself.
Yeah, and I guess by this point, Wonder Woman's kind of recovering, and she throws up her magic lasso to grab GL and gets him away from the golden gas. And then GL has enough strength and the mind to use his ring to make, it looks like a basket. And I don't know how it looks on the version you're looking at this, but Batman goes like, you know, backside down into this basket, and his one leg is up in the air, and his one hand, and they look like they're, you know, colored like blue and gray, but then the other ones are pitch black.
Yeah, and why is the basket that he's creating with his ring not green?
Yeah, it's regular, like a brown basket, like you would see like at Easter.
It's just weird. And then, of course, Kronos disappears, as did everybody else. We get an explanation it's pointed out that they've all vanished in time and space. And I just love that panel of the three of them, you know, like all fading, Kronos, Felix Faust, and Dr. Alchemy by Mike Sikofsky and Bernard Sachs. It's quite eerie.
Yeah, that's really, really good. And I just noticed, too, in that panel, and I hadn't seen it before, I don't know if I just missed it or wasn't there, Dr. Alchemy's barf-colored hood has an A on it, so you know that it's his.
Oh, yes, he should have D in case he forgets the whole thing.
And then here, this bottom panel at page 13 is where we get, you know, the crux of the story here, where we see, you know, these three villains from Earth 1 meet with the three villains from Earth 2. And then they kind of explain, you know, who they are and how they got to be here. And that's a pretty neat scene, too, where we have our buddy, the Wizard here. And it shows him fighting Green Lantern from Earth 2 and Black Canary. And he's throwing a bunch of wooden objects at Green Lantern, knocking him over because that's his kryptonite, let's say, for a better lack of a better term in Earth 2. And then using a giant fan to just blow Black Canary away.
But she's obviously got some good glue on the inside of her wig because it doesn't come off. I mean, this goes back to your previous point about, you know, sort of the villains knowing the hero's weaknesses, because, you know, so far we've had John attacked by fire, Superman by green key, Hal Jordan by yellow mist, and now we got Alan Scott assailed by wood. I mean, the lesson is that these heroes really need to stop advertising their weaknesses.
Yeah, and then we see the Fiddler here, and again, I'm not doubting the Fiddler's prowess, but he is able to stop Hawkman, the Flash, and the Atom, all with just his fiddle. It's like, I don't know here.
The fiddle just seems to be able to do absolutely anything they needed to do.
Yeah, kind of like the Philosopher's Stone. It's like a catch-all for anything he can think of.
Yeah, I just want one. I wish I'd done music.
Yeah, I would like to have one too, although I'm sure it would sound completely awful. At least I'd be able to get what I want.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, just belt out an awful tune and a winning lottery ticket just appears. That's what I would try.
Yeah, I love the. I mean, I know these are golden age designs, but I just love the designs of the villains. You got with you know the Wizard with his sort of split fishtail beard and twirling his mustache, and you know the Fiddler looking like a mad maestro, and the Icicle looking like evil Jack Frost. Was Jack Frost evil anyway? He may have been, but they're just so striking on the page.
Yeah, they look really good, and then yeah, it shows Icicle putting Hourman in a block of ice, and then just putting the freeze on Dr. Fate as well. So yeah, good intro for the three of them. I really like that, and you know, it just kind of they just kind of go back and forth these six villains about how you know this is what we're gonna do. We're going to commit these crazy crimes, and then go to opposite Earths and just you know hang out and chill and just go to like you know. A resort or something. And, you know, that sounds fantastic, but we know villains, they just can't help themselves with, you know, getting into shenanigans.
Absolutely. You know, within a few days, they're robbing banks and casinos and back into it.
Yeah. And the Fiddler here, you know, he basically tells the little backstory here on how the three of them found out about these multiple Earths. He said how he's got his fiddle and it looks like he's, you know, it looks like they're almost like on a chain gang here, the three of them. And the Fiddler's like, oh, I'll just use my fiddle to stop, you know, these guards that are coming after us. And he starts playing a little tune and it says, it seems we've been shifted to another universe. And I have read this story where it says they ended up on the same stage in Central City where, the Flash, Barry Allen, was transported then to Earth 2. Where he met Jay Garrick for the first time in Flash of Two Worlds.
There you go. I mean, who says DC didn't have continuity? And how lovely that when you're on a chain gang, you're allowed to have your supervillain fiddle.
Yeah, so that's really cool. And then, yeah, it's you know, chapter three, it says in the book here. It's just basically, again, them just saying, hey, we're going to, this is what we did when we got to the Earth. You know, we grabbed the loot from the show And then he said, you know, they just kind of made a pact that they were going to, you know, buddy up and commit crimes here. But then we actually see them, you know, on page 17, then we see how the Flashes, you know, how they have them trussed up. And it was, you know, like I said in the synopsis, because they do know of each other's villains and these multiple Earths. So they would have been able to, you know, alert the JSA and the Justice League about the shenanigans that were going on, right?
Absolutely, you know, they've got to have a plan, they've got to explain it to everybody, they've got to enact it. But I do like this page where you've got the two on page 17, where you've got the two flashes in their bubbles, and you're like, you know, they're both in heroic poses and they can't move. And then you've got the fiddler, you know, between the two, you know, being really, really a showman, you know, waving his baton about because he's apparently the composer as well as the fiddler, and then taking a bow to the heroes. It's nice. Mike Sikorsky.
Yeah, that middle panel, I like Jay Garrick. He's like got this really wide stance and has his arms folded, while Barry has his hands on his hips and his one foot like tipped up there. It almost looks like he's doing like an Irish jig there or something.
Diddly dub.
So, but yeah, great scene there. But yeah, here we are. Then it's like, okay, we've done what we said we're going to do. We have all these millions of dollars. You know, we're just going to live the good life now. And I love it. It says, it is not long before the sight of so much wealth about them causes the crime champions from Earth 2 to itch for action. And that's what's going on. They're at a casino and they're thinking, hey, there's all this money at this casino. You know, let's rob the casino. And it's like, dude, you already have plenty of money. Just retire.
Yeah, it's just a hobby, basically, isn't it? I love the page, though, the fact that, you know, you got this incredibly cool-looking early 60s beach resort building on the seafront. You've got the supervillains in the Hawaiian shirts and cookie hats. And you see again, although you did see on the previous page in the flashback of the prison camp, which I hadn't realised, really, or I'd forgotten, that the fiddler actually wears a wig. He's got his wig on a headstand and he's baldy. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. At first, when I flipped the page and looked at that, I'm like, what's Luthor in this one? I'm like, oh, wait, that's not him. Because I didn't realize the guy was wearing a wig. But I like the hat on the other guy there. And then he's got this long cigarette there. He looks like Groucho Marx.
Yeah, it's just excellent. I mean, I could probably read a whole issue of these characters just wandering around being vaguely evil in a casino. And that panel below, where one's wearing a hat with a spotty hat band and the other one's going hat with a stripy band, like three cool crooks in a casino. And Mike Sikorsky, he drew the best 60s dames with their, you know, proto beehive bouffant type things, and, you know, sort of little sort of criminal type gangsters or very dubious looking gamblers. I just love this whole aesthetic.
Yeah, that's a really, really good panel there that you just called out on page 18. That's fantastic work there. You know, that's what's going on there. And then, again, they just can't stop. And it's, I suggest we challenge the Justice League of America to a showdown battle and get rid of them once and for all. We'll show our friends that their enemies are no match for us. We can work out traps against which the Justice League members will be absolutely helpless. And then, meanwhile, from a crystal ball in the souvenir room in the secret headquarters of the Justice League, where the members meet to discuss their recent defeat, there's a voice coming from the crystal ball, and it says, "Members of the Justice League, this is Felix Faust offering you another chance to catch us. You failed once, but surely you'd like to try again." So again, they've already done this once, like, let them know what they're going to do and when they're going to do it and how they're going to do it, and they got away with it. Like, why would you keep tempting fate?
It's a compulsion. They just couldn't help themselves. They're absolutely bonkers, a lot of them.
Yeah, so that's exactly what happens. But, you know, this time, you know, we see that, you know, not only are they challenging them, but it's not really to get away from them with, you know, get away with the crime, but it's to, you know, entrap them, which I thought was like, okay, you were already on the Earth and they didn't know who you were. You were able to get away with these crimes. Like, why do you need to trap them? I just didn't get that. I thought, okay, like, just why couldn't you just leave Waldorf alone? But like you said, it's a sickness.
I thought, yeah, I mean, I think by this point in writing the story, Gordon Fox had a lot of coffee or a lot of drinks or something else, because this plan that the villains come up with is so incredibly complicated, depending on them, you know, these three villains dressing up as Dr. Alchemy, Kronos, and Felix Faust and duplicating their gimmicks. And an 8-part plan, the heroes have to touch 8 different objects before they'll be, you know, thrown into stasis or whatever. It's absolutely ludicrous. It's so just Byzantine.
Yeah, it's very convoluted. It's like it probably had a very low success rate, but it still had some kind of success rate because it actually works, right?
But it doesn't. And the next few pages is, you know, as the heroes racing the casino town, and you've got the little battles, like, you know, Kronos firing little numbers out of a clock at Batman, and Wonder Woman being thrown into a moose, so she touches the moose as part of the plan. Batman touches things from a slot machine, etc. It's absolutely balmy, but it's such fun to see these colourful characters doing ludicrous things to one another.
Yeah, they basically, like you said, they have the answer for everything here, and you know, they do have them caught in their own headquarters here that they can't get out, and they're just, it doesn't matter, you know, which superhero tries their power, like GL's ring doesn't work, and you know, super strength doesn't work, telescopic vision from Superman, and then something I didn't realize, Martian Manhunter has Martian vision. I'm not sure I ever heard of that before.
No, he did. It's basically, it's all Superman's visions in one, pretty much. You can do whatever Superman does with his eyes, because he obviously had powers, plus the telepathy, the invisibility, the intangibility. Very, very impressive.
And then there's a tiny little panel of the Atom trying to slip through the keyhole, but he can't even get through the keyhole. There's some kind of magic stopping all of them from getting out of there. And that's when they're just like, hey, wait a minute. Like, hey, there's this Merlin's magic crystal ball. Maybe we can, use that to, get some help here. So they all join hands, you know, a la the cover. And then we see the Flash, and he comes out of a puff of smoke and says, I'm trapped, myself, my fellow members. But you've been up against villains from a second Earth vibrating close to our own. Listen. And he says, use the crystal ball to summon the Justice Society to Earth One. They won't be bound by the magic that hampers you. And sure enough, that's what they do. And, you know, we get some scenes here that, you know, are indicative of what we saw on the cover and then the splash page, right?
We do. I mean, I love the car where Barry just explains he knows what's going on and how to sort it out. But, I mean, the fact they've got this crystal ball, you know, going back to an earlier issue, again, good continuity. And just, the little panel of the JSA appearing above the crystal ball, they're so happy and serene. And then that picture at the bottom with the two teams just socializing, that's always my favorite bit of any JLA JSA team up. If it's not in there, I'm upset. And just having, you know, it's like the tall by comparison Atom bending down and shaking hands with the little Atom, and you know, sort of the two Green Lanterns meeting and thing. It's just, I mean, what did you make of it? I love it.
Yeah, I really love it, especially, like you said, the two Atoms shaking hands where Al Pratt's kind of bending down to shake the hand of the little Atom there. I really, really like it. That's a really good panel. Again, it's, you know, a 60-year-old comic, but if you read this comic, it's very fun and very endearing, and just all the history that's happened since then, it's really going to, you know, come rushing forward to, you know, longtime readers.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is the first time in Garden of Foxy, and then he's saying an exciting historic meeting, I would think, this takes place. And, you know, he could not have been more right. And in fact, there's a hint at the end of the part two that he's already planning another team up. So he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah. So basically, you know, like I said, they switch places, switch worlds. And that's what happens. You know, the Justice League is on Earth 2, and they're going to go after those villains. And the JSA is on Earth 1. And they're, you know, it says they pierce the magical barrier that cannot hold them because it was not directed against their persons. And then we do see another little interlude here where Hal Jordan, Green Lantern, and the Green Lantern from Earth 2 as well, they are heading to, I don't know how they found out where the Flashes are being held, but they're heading in that direction because they want to help those two guys not be imprisoned anymore, bust them out of their little jail, right?
Yeah, I suppose Flash told them through the crystal ball. But I mean, this is such a good, you know, logical extension of Gardner Fox's usual plot of having the heroes swap places to fight each other's villains, where here you have the two teams swap places to fight each other's villains. It's excellent stuff. And just these final three panels, you know, it's setting up what's to come, bit of foreboding, really cinematic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah, and I like the little blurb at the end. It says, definitely not the end. The startling, stupendous climax of this story in which the superheroes of the Justice League team up with their alter egos, the Justice Society, will appear in the next issue. And that's when I knew I was in trouble. I was like, uh-oh, I better call Mark.
I know. I mean, I did think I'd say, nah, Billy, we'll do a part two in another show next year. But no, it's great. I mean, I wanted to to read on anywhere. So then we come to page, the second issue. And what do you make of the cover?
Oh, this is really cool. There's only one little nitpick I have. You know, Hal Jordan's, the way his body is twisted is a little funky there. He's like kind of bent in half. But other than that, I love this cover. It's like a blue background, like they're out in outer space. And you have the two Green Lanterns, and they're trying to free the two Flashes that are in these floating cages that are all stuck together by a chain. And then all the other, a bunch of the other heroes, like you have Black Canary and Wonder Woman in one of the little prison cells. And then you have Martian Manhunter and Hawkman. And then the bottom one is Dr. Fate and Green Arrow. I really, really like it.
I've always adored this cover. I've never noticed the Green Lantern pose before, and I can't unsee it now because that is very much a Gil Kane Green Lantern pose, and it's not been pulled off quite as well by, again, is this on Matkowski again?
Or is it all this Murphy? This is all Murphy Anderson, this one, yeah.
See, I knew that somehow. Gosh, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, again, just a slight little nitpick on it, but other than that, I love it, and there's a Alan Scott is thinking to himself, only by using the combined might of our power rings can we hope to free our fellow members trapped in those space prisons. And then at the bottom it says, a sensational superstar spectacular featuring the Justice League and Justice Society, Crisis on Earth 2. And yeah, fantastic. Really, really like it a lot. And then, you know, you flip the page and there's a really cool splash page here. And again, we have script Gardner Fox and Mike Sikowski and Bernard Sachs, and then the artwork, and Gaspar Saladino on letters. So same team. And what do you think of this crazy splash page? This one has the exposition I read for the synopsis. It recapped issue 21. But other than that, what do you think of this?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, I love, like most superhero fans, I love floating heads. And okay, they're not floating heads on the cover, a la Marvel. But, if, you know, there's no... I mean, nowadays you can read a comic, and if a character's... You know, if it's not the title character and a supporting character or a villain is named at all, it's probably on page 19 or something. Whereas here, headshots, names, groupings, and of course, because Wonder Woman's a girl, she gets script for her name. You know, everyone else, blocky fonts, Wonder Woman, swirly, girly writing. Black Canary doesn't, because she's not as girly as Wonder Woman. But I love it. I also love about the Justice League was the fact that they had this long, skinny version of the logo that they would use on the splash page. And I think they also had one that was at an extreme angle for some times. It just mixed things up a little bit. Yeah, I think it's great. As I say, the fact you've got all these words just lets you get straight into the story.
Yeah, and I really like that it has, you know, includes the villains as well. Like, a lot of times when you see these and it does these roll calls, it'll just have the heroes, but not the villains. So I really like that it includes them as well.
Yeah, because they're as, you know, they're as important as anybody else in this story.
Yeah, that's what I think too. Because I, you know, thinking back to some other ones, you know, big crossovers like, you know, in All-Star Squadron and stuff like that, I feel like they'd, you know, they'd have a roll call page, but then they wouldn't have the villains. They would just have the heroes. And I thought, why do they do that a lot of times? I thought it'd be, to me, it's a lot better if you have the villains as well. I really like them, including them on this page.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful page. Just makes me want to get into the story.
Absolutely. So, all right. Well, there's a tiny little synopsis here, a couple of sentences on the Grand Comics database for this one. It says the Justice League of America and the Justice Society of America fight their own villains on the opposite Earths until they are mystically transported to cages in space. They escape and take down the gathered villains. So, all right. Well, yeah. So why don't we start off? You know, this picks up right exactly where the other one left off with the two Green Lanterns flying through the netherworld here. That's like kind of between the two Earths, right?
Yeah. This is, again, talking of awkward Hal Jordan poses, you got Alan Scott just, you know, with his arm, with his ring out like traditionally, and Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, is above him, but with his back to him, as if he's flying backwards or something. I have no idea what's going on. But again, one of the things I like about Mike Sikowski is his page is a storytelling, is at times so darn chaotic, but it works. You're just really pulled into the story. So kinetic.
Yeah. He's really, really good at action, I think, for sure. Because then, you know, you get that other panel right next to the lanterns there, and it's got Adam, Hourman, Black Canary, Hawkman, and Dr. Fate. And, you know, the two flyers are, of course, flying, but the other three are kind of running towards the reader here. I really like that. Again, it's like a borderless panel, just with some speech bubbles, of course, you know, but it looks really cool.
Absolutely, because, you know, I think when Mike Skotsky was drawing, obviously he probably knew that to fit all these figures in and the speech bubbles, don't put the panel border there because it gives a little bit more room.
Yeah, and then this scene coming up here, you and I were having a little fun on Twitter, putting some of these panels out there of the shenanigans that's about to ensue. So we see Adam and Hourman, they end up at the Clayville Natural History Museum, and the Fiddler's there, and he has a special little a party for them involved. He starts fiddling, and it almost makes these animals come to life, a polar bear and a gorilla.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know whether they're stuffed exhibits or just dummies, but somehow he manages to animate them.
Yeah, like, you know, it's interesting that, you know, our man, at some point in this issue, I think it's an issue, it could have been the previous one, but I think it's in this one, he does say about how he's made his Miraculo pills even more effective. So the fact that he's punching a polar bear, whether it's, you know, an animated stuffed polar bear or he changed it somehow into a real polar bear, that's quite a feat. But I got, well, if he, you know, has the Miraculo pills and he's even more jacked up than usual, I get that. But we have the Atom here and he's punching this gorilla and I'm thinking, well, it looks like they're going to take them down easily. Well, not so, because now we have a kangaroo and a pterodactyl joining the fight as well.
Yeah, because it was disappointing because when you get that reference to, because I think he doesn't just say he's more, you know, stronger. I think he makes reference to having more powers or abilities or something, but you don't see any of them. And isn't this the point at which, well, Atom's in the cyclotron costume, so he's got the radioactive punch he's got at that point, or something, nuclear punch?
Yeah, probably. That's why he's able to, you know, take some of these guys down, because he punches the, you know, like I said, the gorilla, and you can tell it hurts him, and punches the pterodactyl here that's kind of coming after him. But I do like how they seem like they know it's not going to go well here, that they're going to be outnumbered. And our man says, Adam, can you manage to hurl that winged reptile in my direction? So it looks like he punches him, and maybe he does throw him, and he says, coming up, one pterodactyl on the wing. And it just happens to hit a little switch on our man's belt here. It's like, it was like a one in a million chance, and it happened, right?
One in a million. It was planned. I mean, I put those three panels on Twitter last night. It just made me laugh because I was thinking, you know, presumably our man at that point already had his kid, you know, Rick Tyler, because that is really, you know, taking a risk with your manhood.
Yeah, it really lands like literally, maybe 6 inches above his jewels there. So,
oh yes,
that could have ended very badly for him. But he luckily, I guess,
killed probably.
Yeah, luckily he has a good aim there, apparently, by the Atom. So Fiddler's like, oh crap, you know, they're getting the better of me here. I better run, and he doesn't even get 5 feet away, and they jump and grab him. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, so this is going to be it. The good guys are going to win. Everything's going to be okay here. Well, we then see the Icicle, and he's in an art museum somewhere, and Dr. Fate tries to come at him, and he freezes him, and it looks like he's going to take care of him pretty easily, but then Dr. Fate uses some lightning to make fire and melt the ice, right?
Okay, well, yeah, because the more they're in action, the less rusty they get, because Dr. Fate mentions I've got a little bit rusty, that wouldn't have got me in the old days. But I can't remember after this first team up any particular reference or instance of the JSAs being even remotely rusty. It's just like they've been totally revivified by this one adventure. And, you know, no references to crow's feet or grey hairs or powers resting. Because you actually get a reference in the first issue to the powers maybe being a little bit weaker than they were, but no evidence. You know, they're just having such a brilliant time that they're on top form, and that's where they stay.
Yeah, maybe they were, you know, maybe they have an X-Men danger room that they practice in after this to get better. I don't know.
That could be it, yeah. Mm.
So, yeah, he melts the ice, and it he directs it towards our buddy the Icicle here, and it's kind of like a big sea of, you know, moisture here washes them away. So, okay, there's two down. And then Black Canary and Hawkman are after our buddy here, the Wizard. And he always reminds me of Zatara, the way he dresses. You know, he kind of looks like a magician. And yeah, he uses a crazy little, you know, wand here to you know, pretty much take the two of them down very easily. But then Black Canary uses, you know, some of her costume here to get them out of the jam, right?
She really does. Like, I just love the fact that these animated creatures, she says, oh, I can't shake this man rock off. And you know, we've all had days like that.
Yeah, they look like, trying to describe them, they're just like grayish and black with like, you know, like muscular looking, but I'm trying to think, the one on the top of what is that, page 7 there, it almost looks like Crusher Creel, that Marvel character.
And I think does he also look like one of the Demons 3, one of Felix Faust's cronies, or...
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, they're quite impressive. I mean, you know, and just the way the panel's composed with, you know, where she's, you know, stretched down between them, the wizards in the middle, the wizards in the middle, sort of casting his wand with the two men in either side. It's very exciting stuff.
Yeah, and then she thinks to herself, my one hope is to prevent the wizard from directing the actions of his rocky puppets. And the caption box reads, from the amulet, she lifts a burning glass and focuses it upon some nearby bushes. And it says, so intense is the heat from her special gadget that the bushes burst into flame. Upward rolls a thick...
I didn't just say it was a little, you know, just the glass ornament, because a burning glass makes it sound like the glass is burning. So presumably it's just like a magnifying glass effect. But you could just say it's just a piece of glass from a brooch or a neck, what they call choker.
Yeah, they're making it sound a little more impressive than it really is. I mean, it's just like a piece of glass that she's using, like you said, like a magnifying glass to start a fire. Yeah.
It's a shame that she doesn't have all the... Did you ever read that Golden Age Black Canary story where she suddenly sort of escapes from a building by summoning a bunch of canaries and climbing down on the backs of the canaries or something? That would have worked.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's fantastic. But... Yeah, so he then, you know, now there's fire and smoke between him and the rock monsters, and if he doesn't have visual contact, I guess he can't direct them. So at this point, she starts, you know, running after him, and he says, my wand turning into a medieval battle mace will knock you out cold. And he throws it at her, and she easily dodges it. And that panel on page 8, that might be my favorite panel this whole book, you know, when the mace, aka the wand, goes flying by her there. What do you think of that?
I mean, yes, I noted that as well. That just the sheer glee on Dinah's face is marvellous. I mean, I sort of wish that, although he didn't really do it, that Mike Sikorsky had broken the panel a little bit to give us the bottom of her chin. But no, it's just wonderful stuff. Really,
yeah,
nicely done.
It looks great. She looks fantastic. Her face, her features, the lines in her hair. It's really, really, really top level stuff. It's great. But then she does like a judo throw on him here. But he then starts turning her into marble, which is kind of wild. And then he did dispose of Hawkman, or so he thought earlier. But then Hawkman, and this is wild too, he comes back into the scene here with two giant hawks carrying him.
Yeah, so he's carrying his wings in his that were carrying him off into space in his arms. So that apparently negates the graviton type effect, and he's got these huge great eagles whose language speaks and who obeys commands carrying him down by his harness. And he's, you know, he's even more topless than usual with carrying his own, you know, grabbing the mace. It's the imagination. I mean, you think of comics these days, and you know, when it comes to a fight scene, it's just generally, we have a word in Scotland, the guddle, i.e. you can't really tell what's going on, it's just random. Whereas here, every moment of the fight is choreographed by the writer and, you know, perfectly placed on the page by the artist. And I mean, you know, obviously the art and comics today is wonderful in so many ways, but the thought put into the craftsmanship that you got in those days, I do miss it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with you on that one. But I like the next page too, page 9 there, the top panel. They you know, the hawks just make, they have him by, like I said, his harness, and they swoop by with him underneath them, and he grabbed the mace and he clobbers the wizard with this mace. I thought he probably broke his jaw, man.
Well, it sounds right, because the wizard threw the same thing at Black Canary's face.
Yeah, he did. But I was like, man, I was waiting for a little blood to be spilled here. But I thought, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, that's not going to happen in this comic. But yeah, so they're good to go. They're like, all right, let's get the wizard off to jail. And then again, there's another just one small panel showing the Green Lanterns still trying to, you know, get their way to the Flashes there. But there's like, you know, like all these whirlwinds and thing like that slowing them down, right?
Yeah, and then this time it's Alan Scott who's a little bit broke back.
Yeah, he's really twisted, kind of crazy there. But it's a small panel, so it doesn't look as bizarre. But the more you look at it, the more you're like, something's not right there. His back's broken, I think.
I do. Yeah.
Oh, and then here we go. We have Martian Manhunter, and he's got the Atom on his shoulder, and he's carrying Green Arrow. And then we see Wonder Woman and Batman in their vehicles there, which that's a really cool panel there, right?
Absolutely. And then even after that, a cooler panel, I think, with Superman helping Aquaman water ski across the world to the next rendezvous.
Yeah, that's super cool. Then it says, at a carnival, which Felix Faust has been robbing of its special charity day receipts. And then, what's this? Martian Manhunter? Adam? Green Arrow? I thought they were safely locked up in their headquarters. But no matter, this pinwheel will help me defeat them. And this comic, you know, 60 years old, taught me a new word here. The caption box says, with a triumphant chuckle, he speaks the cantrip, which will make his magic work. And there's an editor's note. A cantrip is a magical incantation. And it's a legit word. It's not, you know, BS.
So basically, you have 8 words at the bottom to explain a single word, which you don't really need because you could have had chant or spell or anything. So this must have been Gardner Fox or Julius Schwartz, the editor, just wanting, yeah, to teach the kids a new word, which is brilliant because it's where we don't like to be invulnerable and things.
Yeah, I really like that. I was just like, oh, that is super cool. Again, you know, I'm just, you know, you're learning new stuff many years later from a comic that's 60 years old. That's just fantastic.
I looked it up, and Mr. Google claims that cantrip is Scottish. I've not heard of it, but I don't doubt it's probably in Macbeth somewhere. Who knows?
Fantastic. So, yeah, and Faust here, he starts taking it to them. He's using this pinwheel to kind of like spin the three of them around. And of course, it's like throwing off their, you know, equilibrium and stuff like that. So he's just laughing at them, basically. But Green Arrow's like, oh, all my arrows are falling out of my quiver. And there's like arrows flying everywhere. And he just then Faust just gestures again. And he has like a big target, circular target, come up in front of him just to protect him from it. And they just all hit into that.
It's just fantastic. I mean, what is a pinwheel? Is it just like a Wheel of Fortune type thing?
Yeah, that's what it looks like to me when he has it there. Almost like it has a bunch of numbers on it. So I don't know if you just, you know, spin that numbers, and if it lands on, you know, the number, your lucky number or whatever, you win a prize or something, maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, but yeah, over the page, I do love that panel of the various heroes, Superman, Green Arrow, and John Johns spinning round. It's masterfully done, and with Green Arrow probably thinking that he wishes he invented green Velcro for his quiver. And then a couple of panels later, when you've got the Martian Manhunter, you know, blowing GA's arrows right at R4, you've got 4 or 5 little heads, and you just say, what, those old pictures of like cherubs blowing down wind at the earth and things.
Yeah, that's really cool. And then what is this shenanigans here at the bottom of page 11? Green Arrow, the caption box says, as his shafts dig deep into the magically magnetic target, the bowman manages to bring out a tiny bow and arrow and fires it. And it's like literally a little bow and arrow that like the Atom would use. What?
I'm sorry, I'm just laughing too much to comment. I mean, I can generally come up with a reason for any arrow Green Arrow might have, like the lead arrow, but an atom-sized arrow, how would he even fire that? How would he get his feet in there? Madness.
Yeah, it's absolute insanity. But he manages to fire off an arrow, and it goes towards the Atom, and he grabs onto the arrow, so it kind of pulls him away from being, you know, spun around like in a circular motion from the pinwheel, and it lands on the target, and he just keeps using his momentum there to keep flipping up higher and higher till he gets onto the other side and sucks Felix Faust right in the jaw and knocks him out.
I have to say, Ray Palmer, for a university scientist, he is quite the acrobat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's he doing in his spare time? He must be in a circus.
Yeah, he's probably just doing it to avoid having to spend time with the horrible gene.
That's true. But page 13, I do love that panel of him socking Felix Faust in the jaw. That's a good panel there too, right?
Oh, I do. I mean, the amount of detail, the shadowing and lines that he puts in, I think he really, really enjoys drawing Felix Faust more than the other villains.
Yeah, so then we see our buddies Batman and Wonder Woman here. So maybe we should have known even back then they were maybe going to be a couple, right? They're after Dr. Alchemy.
Oh, come on. At this point, Wonder Woman's been a couple with everybody, probably even the horse.
Maybe even Supergirl's horse.
Yeah, Comet, yes.
Oh, man. So, yeah, they're going to, you know, track him down. But all of a sudden, she says, there are no wind currents here in this valley. If I'm tossed off, I'll fall to the ground like a stone. And I'm thinking, so what? You're Wonder Woman. She's, like, invulnerable. Big deal, right?
I'm not sure that she was invulnerable then, though. She, you know, she basically, as I understand it, you know, she was at the peak of what a human could do and had learned to ride the air currents. But I don't think she was actually. I mean, she was treated as, you know, DC's, you know, most impressive woman, and she was in terms of having the comic books and being in publication all throughout the 50s and everything. But she wasn't in terms of power. She wasn't up there with Superman and John Jones at that point.
Mm. Well, I forgot to mention too, as they're both in their vehicles heading towards our buddy Dr. Alchemy here, he uses the Philosopher's Stone to change their vehicles into, you know, winged horses here, Pegasus.
That's not a bad trade-off.
No, and it looks really cool too. It's a really good panel where, you know, Wonder Woman's on this white horse, of course, because, you know, her invisible plane is obviously drawn white, even though it's supposed to be invisible. But then we have Batman's, you know, black bat plane or jet or whatever you want to call it, turn into this ebon Pegasus here. And it looks really cool.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that, if it had nothing else, that would have been a superb cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really cool. So he's going to try to take them down. But, you know, Wonder Woman, she uses her magic lasso to get her and Batman out of some trouble here. But this is a little gonzo here, too. So the two of them, they kind of rope this, you know, piece of wood here. And she says, you know, it almost looks like a hitching post to get them down on the ground safely, which, okay. Then all of a sudden, he uses the Philosopher's Stone to kind of like bury them under a bunch of rubble. And what about this craziness here on page 15 where Wonder Woman pulls like a Superman here?
Yeah, I mean, there's me going, you know, she's not invulnerable, but she's busy spinning around and moving through rock. But again, I can no prize that away by saying she's actually pointing her titanium or whatever it was, Amazonium tiara at the rock and cutting it. That was a cutting device. I do remember that. But again, the fact that, you know, it's Wonder Woman who sort of pretty much saves the day here with her ability to ride air currents and her skill with the magic lasso. Both things that DC's done away with. And, you know, nowadays she is too powerful. I mean, she can fly, so she doesn't have the plane. She never uses the lasso actually as a lasso. And it's not as much fun.
Yeah, and then she charges at Dr. Alchemy here, and she looks like she's going to pound the crap out of him. But then Batman behind her says, he goes, Dr. Alchemy says, can't anything stop you, Justice League characters? I'll turn you into solid lead. Maybe that'll hold you for a while. And Batman says, you've given me an idea, Dr. Alchemy. And he says, half in and half out of his escape tunnel. Batman makes the most desperate throw of his life as he bullets a tiny glass pellet straight for the Matter Transformer. And he says, if I miss, he'll get Wonder Woman before she can reach him. And this little stone hits the Philosopher's Stone and starts a fire. And again, I'm not
a chemist. It's a burning glass, Billy. It's a burning glass, obviously. They've all got them.
Yeah, it's like, I'm not a chemist, but I don't know about this. Would this actually work here?
Probably not.
So, yeah, it causes him to drop the Philosopher's Stone, and then it doesn't show it, but they probably pummel the crap out of him.
Never.
But okay, back in the dimension between worlds, finally the Green Lanterns, Hal and our buddy, I am blanking on his name here,
Alan
Scott, they finally bust into this room, this building here where the Flash is, Jay and Barry are, and they look like they're in bubble gum, and they're trying and trying and trying with their power rings, and they can't bust them out. And I love how, you know, Hal, he tries to use like his like a saw he makes with his ring, and then it looks like Alan makes maybe an axe.
It's something for the Acme Green Lantern Company.
It's what Wile E. Coyote would use here.
But it's quite exciting though. You got these little intervals with the two Green Lanterns trying to get the flashes, and you know, eventually, you know, they get them out, but that, you know, they fail, and then it's back to the regular rest of the story, back to Kronos and his captivating costume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's way better than Dr. Alchemy's, right? Yeah. But we have Superman and Aquaman. They come swooping in, and this is wild. So they jump up on his sundial here, and he goes, "My time's run out. I'm your prisoner." And Superman says, "Watch out for a trick, Aquaman." And Aquaman's trying to get on the sundial, and all of a sudden, on the next page there, page 16 or no 17, I'm sorry, he's laying on the ground, and almost like he's clutching his chest, having a heart attack.
It does look painful, yeah, but he's been attacked by his Kronos special vibration watch that's put him in a coma.
Yeah, put him in a coma. So then he basically says to Superman, "Listen, pal, you know, you better do what I say or he's going to die." And he says, "Unless you expose him to the healing rays of a certain kryptonite meteor, which I've placed on a little island in the Pacific, he is doomed and you only have 1 minute in which to do it. So it's time you got started." And again, when did he have time to prepare all this?
I don't know. Since when did green kryptonite act as a healing ray for, never mind ordinary people, but Atlanteans, half Atlanteans?
Atlantean coma patients.
Yeah, but the fact that Superman puts Aquaman by the healing kryptonite, and then obviously he succumbs to it himself, he could have just sort of thrown Aquaman from a distance and stayed in the air away from it.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Like, did he really need to go like right up against it so it would hurt him there like that? But well, whatever. But Aquaman returns the favor, because after he recovers, he pulls Superman away, and then Superman then says, "He isn't anywhere I can see, neither on Earth nor in the sky." And Aquaman says, "That means Kronos is using his sundial vehicle to flee under the sea. I'll command the sea creatures to hunt him down for me." And it does see him. We do see him speaking to them. And there's an octopus and a shark and all sorts of stuff. And then eventually Superman catches up to him. And it's like, okay, everybody's caught now. The story's going to be over, but not quite, right?
Not quite, no. It's like, they fade away again.
Yeah. Then we jump back to the lanterns, and Hal says, "There's only one hope left. Since both flashes can see and hear us," Alan then says, "I catch your drift, GL. Light and sound waves can pass through the bubbles. All we have to do is," and it shows them blasting the bubbles, and it says, "Reduced to protons of light by the power rings, the two flashes burst out of their bubble prisons," which, okay, but it doesn't last long here. Then all of a sudden, you know, everybody starts to kind of disappear again, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure the kids reading this and probably themselves guessed in advance that's how they were going to get them out of the bubble, because it's such obvious science, really.
Right, yeah. How are they going to get out of bubble gum? But, you know, the Leaguers and the JSAers all disappear, and then they reappear on the first page of Chapter 3 here. In the, you know, the cover shot where they're all in these little two-man, two-woman prisons, right?
Yeah, so you can't accuse the cover of not playing fair. And it's nice that the girls get to be together. You know, you put the counterparts together, you put the girls together, you put the two chaps with the ex-chest harnesses together. It's all thought out.
Yeah, I just thought to myself, why wasn't Wonder Woman with Batman and Black Canary with Hawkman like they were in the fight? Oh, ridiculous. But you know, Superman, he's punching, because that's what Superman does, and he's like, I can't you know, get us out of here. And the Atom says, "No matter how hard I try, I can't shrink between the atoms of this cage." And our man's punching away. Oh, and this is, I think, where he says about it. Yeah, he says, I improved my Miraclo pills over the past 20 years to give me even greater powers than I used to have, but to no avail." And all he's doing is punching it. What are these extra powers?
Goodness knows. Exaggeration.
Yeah, he's full of baloney, I think. But, you know, this is a little wild to me, too, here. I didn't realize the Green Lantern's rings could do this. So Hal says, the speech bubble is wild here on page 21. It's going to the Atom and to Hal. And it says, "I can't slip through the atoms of my cage because it was especially designed to prevent it. But maybe you two can make yourselves small and drop between the atoms of your cage. And Hal says, it's an idea. And Alan, worth trying. And they did that. And I did not know that was possible.
I don't think it would be possible in the Green Lantern book. I mean, maybe it's something Alan could do with his magic rings, but it specifically says they're both doing it. So again, I think it's just more baloney.
Yeah, shenanigans here that they can use your rings to go to subatomic size and plummet through the floor of the cage. So they get out and then they bust the flashes out. And then how about the panel of the flashes jumping on the cage to let the girls out there?
Makes sense. You did say earlier that Barry Allen looked like he was about to do an Irish jig or something. So yeah, he's getting it out.
They look like they're dancing, right? Oh, man, that's fantastic. And I'll tell you what, too, this panel on top of page 22. Wow. How awesome is that panel with Superman flying through space and Hal with the ring? And he's like got everybody encased in it except Superman and Dr. Fate. That is fantastic.
Absolutely. You got Alan at the back, you know, encasing the back of the heroes and Dr. Fate flying in space as well. It's pretty impressive. Heroes in a bottle.
Yeah, I love it. They almost look like they're in a bullet, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Green Bullet. It's just marvelous. A little atom ray palm is so tiny that Mike Sikorsky has drawn a little starburst around him, and the colorist helpfully left it white to stand out.
Yeah, so you know where he is. But Felix Faust says, wait, I sense a disaster. So the crime champions are in for it because, you know, the heroes are out of their prison and there's no more tricks finally. And it's a crazy brawl here. So what do you think of these last three pages? So there's two huge pages of just fighting sequences, right?
I do, but before you get to that, back on page 22, we've got the panel where, you know, the villains are realizing that someone, they're coming for them, and it's suddenly the Fiddler cries out, I've got it. There is an Earth 1 and an Earth 2. Somewhere there must be an Earth 3. If we can find the doorway into it before the Justice Champions find us, we can escape them forever. And there you have it. That's next year's team of Earth 3.
Yeah, that's wild. Yeah, and I love how they do start to try to perform this feat, but they don't have enough time, right?
They don't. Now, I also like the way that the Fiddler calls the Mass Justice League and Justice Society the Justice Champions, like the Crime Champions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was neat, too. I was wondering why he did that, and I thought, oh, well, maybe because they're the Crime Champions. It's the Justice Champions. But, yeah, so two full pages of nothing but fights here. You know, the first one we have Icicle, and he's trying to freeze Hourman, Green Arrow, and the Atom, but I'm assuming the Green Arrow used his bow to shoot the Atom at the Icicle, right?
Yeah, it looks like he's maybe been riding the arrow, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's like kind of tailing off there, and he's flying in like he's going to knock him out and sock him right in the jaw. And then we have Aquaman, Wonder Woman, and Jay Garrick, and they all team up on the Wizard, which kind of seems unfair, but I don't know. They were handling them pretty easily earlier.
Serves him right, though. I mean, the Wizard can't be underestimated.
And then Alan Scott, Green Lantern, and Superman sock Dr. Alchemy with a giant boxing glove type, construct there. And then the Fiddler here, he's going to town with his fiddle. But I love how Hal Jordan then is creating other instruments to kind of counteract the Fiddler here.
I don't know what you think. I think he's still dancing there.
Oh, it looks ridiculous. And then Dr. Fate and Batman are attacking Felix Faust with the Flash helping out there, running around like a maniac. Yeah. And then Kronos.
I really like that, you know, rather than being, you know, one big spread of everyone, you know, in little parts of the spread, it's actually, again, six borderless panels, basically. But the effect is just like, I think, nothing that had ever been seen in the Justice League book before that.
Yeah, it's really neat. Yeah, like you said, it's almost like six, horizontal panels just without borders showing these fights that they kind of like. And it's not like they really bleed into each other very much, too. Tiny little bit, but not very much. They're almost like six separate panels.
Absolutely. And we don't have any word balloons. We just have one panel of description on the first page and quite a lot of words on the second page at the top. I'm in two minds about them, Billy. I mean, on the one hand, the fight spread is fantastic and doesn't need the words. I want to take all the words off. But the words that Gardner Fox gives you, they're so lovely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love him being descriptive, even if you see what's going on right in front of you. To me, good writers that write a little bit of description and purple prose, I'm way, way fine with that. I've got no problem.
Absolutely. Because he's ruminating on the fact that the Justice Society had been feeling old, but now they're not so rusty again. They've passed through their baptism of fire and are only too eager to demonstrate the powers that made them famous in their good old days. A phrase Gardner Fox used quite a few times in this issue. But yeah, I mean, goodness, I mean, you get your money's worth just with this fantastic spread.
Yeah, and then that final one is Kronos, and he has like, I don't know, a dozen or so clocks, and he's kind of hurling them, but Martian Manhunter's using his Superman super breath to blow it away, and looks like Black Canary's about to land a big punch on him, too.
It's pretty exciting to see.
Yeah, and then the very last page, you know, there's only two horizontal panels there, and it's, you know, the whole team, the two teams, I should say, standing there over, you know, triumphantly over the defeated villains. And I like how the Atom looks like he's standing on the knee of the Wizard.
I think he is, and then Mike Sikowski. He's done a really good job of sort of, you know, characterizing the six villains in different ways. Where you got Dr. Alchemy sort of looking like he's sort of about to fall, hugging a rock. The Wizard sitting up on the ground looking groggy. And the other four of them just completely knocked out in different directions, while the heroes are all in a big lineup, but not one that looks too sort of messy. Talking about them, looking at them, looking triumphant. Excellent composition.
Yeah, and then that final one, you know, we have Hawkman. He says, "We're going to keep in touch. There's no telling when we may be called up to join forces again." And Aquaman says, "I can just see Snapper Carr's face when he learns he had to miss our biggest adventure of all because he had to take college exams. I hope he passed his test as well as we did ours." And that's a really good panel. A lot of really good detail in there.
It's a really good panel. But again, it's like Gardner Fox did the same gag in the first issue, in like about page 3 of the first issue, where Green Arrow's basically laughing his head off that Aquaman's missing all the fun. Not Aquaman, the Snapper Carr's missing all the fun. And you wonder if just Gardner Fox thought, "I've got a good story here. Why ruin it with Snapper Carr?"
Yeah, so yeah, really cool, man. These are really two really fun issues. And like I said, this was the first time I read them, and I had a blast with them. They were a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reader response was obviously very good. I think they did it again. It was, well, probably eight issues a year back then, Justice League, pretty much in a year's time anyway, and kept on doing it because it's such fun. And again, the fact that they've established this rotating seven membership thing for the Justice Society, good excuse to, if you need one, which you don't, just to bring in different members each year as you want to pick and choose them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And there's the cover to this archive edition as well. It does have that an image. I'm not sure who drew this image. It looks different than Sikowski and all inside, but it's, you know, the image of the Justice League sitting there with the crystal ball and the JSA kind of in shadow beneath them. Looks really, really cool.
Ooh, I might have to see if I can summon it through my Merlin's crystal ball.
Oh, man. So, all right. Well, that's going to wrap this one up, man. So fun times here. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate this. And so if anybody wants to follow your exploits, where can they find you?
They can find me at the blog, which is named Too Dangerous for a Girl. They can find me on Twitter at Mart Gray. They can find me commenting all around the internet. They can find me on Facebook under my own name, Martin Gray, G-R-A-Y. And they can find me, well, I might be standing outside their front door right now looking through the window.
Possibly. You might be holding the Philosopher's Stone getting ready to zap somebody.
I might have a little hood on my face, or a little clock dial on my chest, or stripes on my trunks. Who knows? Have a look.
Maybe a horrid green hood with a G on it.
The grinning gray. But no, I've really enjoyed talking about this. And, you know, if you ever want to, you know, talk about another JLA, JSA team up, and we can actually maybe chat about which are our favourites down the years, that would be absolutely wonderful. I'll get some of the boys or whoever to talk team ups of the JLA and JSA. I'd like to hear more.
Me too. That's a fantastic idea. We'll have to all get our brains together in the same chat room and make it happen.
Brilliant. Thanks, Billy.
All right. Well, yep, that's going to wrap us up for this episode. So hopefully, again, we'll be back on schedule here. And just every 2 weeks, be back with another episode. So take care, everybody.